If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
In looking at myself in the mirror, identifying what I'm great at and what I'm not great at, and then finding people that are great at things that I'm not, and finding a way to formulate a team that we can all kind of watch each other six. And that's worked really, really well.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Matt Faircloth, co-founder and president of the DeRosa Group, is a seasoned real estate investor. The DeRosa Group, based in historic Trenton, New Jersey, is a developer and owner of commercial and residential property with a mission to transform lives through real estate. DeRosa creates partnerships to finance select real estate investments and have a proven track record of providing safe, profitable investment opportunities to their clients. Matt, welcome to the show.
Sam, it's an awesome to be here. Thank you. I appreciate you.
The pleasure is all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Where did you start? Where are you now? How did you get there?
I got started. I could be a smart aleck and be like, I started in Baltimore, Maryland in 1975. But no, I will not do that. Although I just did. But I got started in real estate investing on a house hack, you know, in a 3-bedroom, 1-bath, where I lived in 1-bedroom and rented out the other 2 bedrooms to 2 buddies of mine, and quit my job in 2005 to start investing full time after that. So that's my start point. What was your next question? I live in the now, man. What was your next question?
All good. Where'd you start? Where are you now? That's we'll break this up. We'll do it short bus style. Where are you?
I got you. Okay, cool. So I did that in 2005 when I quit my job and all that. And then where I'm at now is I am an author of a book called Raising Private Capital. The tools in the book are things that I learned and used and developed and bumped into brick walls to figure out myself as we built a landlording company and asset company that now owns, you know, well into the over 1,000 units of mostly residential apartments and storefronts and things like that, leased out in 4 different states. And we are the active operator for people that want to invest passively.
Got it. And let's see, where'd you start? Where I know, and how did you get there?
A lot of ups and downs and bumps and sideways and all that, man. We started out managing ourselves, leasing out and managing ourselves, and got just over 100 units under our own efforts and our own build outs.
That was all single family. 100. You had 100 single family homes.
No. In some ways, that would have been better. But no, it was all over the place. A small multi. There's an office building in there. There was some apartments and stuff like that. But it was mostly small. 80% of that was small residential. Some singles, some doubles, some duplexes, and all that. But you know, 4 units and less get scattered out around New Jersey, and that's how we ended up there. Then we started really focusing on raising money from other people, using that track record of building 115 units, and then we expanded out, started attracting more and more dollars to us once we had proven our track record, and took on larger and larger deals. So we went from like buying a smattering of 4 families down this 1 block. And then we transitioned up from there to buying an 18 unit. Then we transitioned up from there to buying a 49 unit. And then we bought a 198 unit. And so we just kind of parlayed our lessons in capital and an investor trust over and over and over again as we grew.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic. Do you own, how much single family do you still, or even up to say quadplex, do you own?
Just the one I'm sitting in right now, brother. That's it. Just my home.
That's it.
I'm like grateful to say that's the only single family I still own. And it's funny, Sam, because single family can be a great asset, but it can also kick your butt if you let it do it, right? And I've had tenants just destroy my single family homes. But from a expense perspective and from a hands-off management perspective, I've said this before, I'll say it again, there is no better investment than a single family home with a tenant that wants to stay there forever and is willing to pay their rent on time and takes care of the place. There's no better investment because
why do you say that?
Because the expense ratio, if you look at it, if you structure the lease agreement where the tenant's got to shovel the snow and they do it, and they got to cut the grass and they do it, you know, and they just take good care of the property and don't take a two bedroom and have eight people living in there or anything like that. And the appropriate amount of heads. And if you transition all the utility bills over to them to where they're paying the water, the sewer, the it's funny if they're supposed to pay the water and they do it, you know, because sometimes they don't and that's bad. But if they do what they're supposed to do and you do what you're supposed to do and maintain the place and everything like that, your expense ratios are very low and the level, the reasons why they would call you are much less. If in a single family home, they're not going to call you and be like, hey man, those people upstairs are being really loud, or the guy next door's has his girlfriend over too late and I hear her coming in and out or whatever it is. As a residential multifamily landlord, take my word, man, you get those phone calls, you know, when I was managing myself in that. So the phone calls are way less and the expenses are way less on your side as the owner. But the risk you bear in a single family home is that the tenant moving out. And then they destroy the place and they cause you $5,000 worth of damage to a place you're making $500 a month in cash flow on. And they jack out, like, you know, 2 years worth of your cash flow gone because they took a sledgehammer to your kitchen cabinets on the way out the door and or whatever it is, or left the place infested with, you know, with roaches and bed bugs and mice. That they can destroy a single family home. It's a lot of square footage in a single family home that they can just train wreck for you. So that's the risk you bear. And also when they move out, it's not like, oh, I've got these other 10 apartments that'll keep carrying my debt service and my expense ratio or whatever. You can go to from $500 a month in cash flow to negative 500 in loss. Yeah, no, not zero, man. You go to loss. Like, oh, that mortgage still needs to get paid, doesn't it? Those real estate taxes aren't going to pay themselves, are they? You know, and everything that shows up from COVID to a tenant either not having to or not choosing to pay their rent, or it goes into any number of reasons from a collection standpoint that you may have. So single family homes are can be very risky as because you teeter between profitability and not. But from a hands-off standpoint and from a expense load standpoint, there is not a better investment that I've seen, aside from maybe holding a mortgage.
Right, right. But even with your saying there's not a better investment, you have transitioned out of it for various reasons.
Right. Yeah, all that. Like, yeah, no, it's so great that we don't do it anymore. And it's because I've gotten burned badly, Sam, by the other side of it, by the bad things that I just said happen. The reason why I know is that all that stuff's happened to me, including taking a sledgehammer to cabinets, you know, like all those things have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had tenants pour concrete down the drain.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, man. You know?
And it was probably a house that was a slab, so you had to jack the slab up to get to it too.
Yeah, no, it wasn't on a slab. It was on most stuff around here is as full basement and all that. So you had to, you take out a, like a 3 foot section, and it's like, I'm not saying that it's not a big deal, you know, and all that, but I'm saying that that, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, and it's deal with it. But yeah, it could have been a lot worse. But anyway, at the end of the day, we grew into multi because of our, we chose to work with passive investors. And you could build, I have friends that have enormous portfolios of single family homes or small multi and singles, and they own all of it themselves. They did it through using the BRRRR strategy of buying, renovating, renting out, refinancing. For us, we chose to work with private capital on the equity side. And it's very hard to buy big multifamily, like 100 units and up, with all your own money, or to use the BRRRR strategy and get the investors out completely on a big multifamily. So we've just chosen to build more of a business around offering passive investments to a lot of people. That's just the road we took. So, and I'm grateful for that road.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's the thing I like about that model is it's scalable. Mm-hmm. There's no end to what you guys can take down. You know, as long as the deal and the money is available, then you guys can always grow.
I said in my book, I know many people that own 100, 200 units of smaller deals and own the whole thing themselves. I know no one that owns in the thousands on units without having to sell equity, including Sam Zell and all those guys, man, the big dogs, Donald Trump, everybody. Talk about anybody that owns in the big multifamily world or in the big housing world. They have all had to dilute themselves by selling equity. You know, this is how it goes. This is, so it's the game.
It's the game, but I mean, it's also, I mean, I think it's great.
It's, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a good game. It's a phenomenal game. And as an owner, I get to go and be the controller and the equitable interest in a big apartment complex. There's no way I would have had the money to write a check for. I do well, but I don't make enough money to go and buy a 336 unit all by myself, or do I choose to? But because I've got a group of investors that believe in me and my team, I can put some money in, but also go out and buy this big apartment complex with a big group of investors and win alongside them.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that, you know, you've done a variety of things as we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could rewind the tape, what are some things maybe that you would do differently?
I bought this office building in Trenton, New Jersey that I was so proud of when we bought it. But I learned the hard way that you cannot change a market. You can only hope to participate in it. And I bought the office building and it's a great asset. And I learned a lot and I wouldn't be where I'm at without it. But if I could rewind the tape, I would have played it a different way. And I would have stayed in my lane of I'm just going to focus on becoming the best multifamily landlord that I can, period. But I was like, oh, let me try this office building. Let me try this. Let me try that. You got to dabble a little bit too as an owner, but the office building was too far outside my beaten path in that. And it's still good. And we're working on other ways to work with it and everything like that. But that's one asset that I was like, if I had to rewind the tape, I probably would have done that. Also, I am a quick start. I tell you that's my Colby, KOLBE, the personality assessment. And I'm not affiliated with them, but that's an assessment I took. And I am off the charts, like jump in, ready, fire, aim, build the parachute on your way down kind of thing. And I have gotten myself into situations before I had a chance to vet the whole thing completely out, not buying multifamily or whatever, because I got a big team that helps me. I got a team that I work with on that side of it. On the other side of it, I'm like, I've gotten into partnerships or fix and flip deals or buying an office building. And I said, we'll figure it out, you know, and all that on. And so there's a few deals that I did that worked out okay, but would have done a little bit better had I spent a little more time doing some little more like nuts and bolting and all and figuring out and just focusing on my core strengths versus, you know, trying to do things that I'm not great at. And I think too many real estate investors try and be all the seats on their real estate bus, not realizing that there's people that can help them that are better at functions of the business than they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's tough, you know, because I would imagine if you're ready, fire, aim, like getting into the weeds and the details is stuff that probably bores you.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
it is. And I can underwrite. I have a background in engineering. I know how to underwrite. I can make numbers make sense to myself, you know, and to my investors and whatnot. And I know numbers very well, but I'd really rather not. And so it's better off for me to work with underwriters on my team than me doing it myself, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is one of the things that, you know, that scaling is bringing on the right team members. What was that like when you guys brought on maybe your first hire or, you know, how did you scale your team? Can we talk about that for a few minutes?
Sure. Well, we tried a few different, we worked on a few different angles on it, you know, meaning like we scaled the team appropriately for the direction the company was going at that time. But I've also redirected my company a few different times. Like we've been like, you know, a couple miles down this road and be like, okay, I'm good to go. I've learned what I'm going to learn. I've made what I'm going to make. And I've decided that I'm going to pick up my car and put it on another road right now. One example specifically of that has been property management. We got in, we managed around 115 units, I said earlier ourselves. And we were thinking about, okay, I'll scale out and as they say, vertically integrate the company and bring in in-house construction, in-house property management, in-house financial management, and just go that direction with it. And I realized that it was going to force me to play in only specific markets if I went that way, meaning like geographic markets, if I went that direction, or I could build this juggernaut of a company that had like a big old team in Pittsburgh and a big old team in Baltimore and a big old team in Trenton or whatever. And where we were starting was Trenton, New Jersey, which is a good market, but it's not a lot of, I didn't want to live and die by that market, you know? And so I decided that what it enabled me to be more of a regional operator and a regional owner was leaving property management to third parties, right? Because property management is actually not a cash flow. It's unless you're managing thousands of units, it's not a moneymaker. It's a necessary evil in that. So that was one of the partnership angles that we went on was we partnered with a construction company operator, partnered with a few other folks, everything like that. And those things had to go away when we picked up our little vehicle of real estate and went on another road that went down the syndication and down the private capital route. And all those things, what I found has worked really well is in looking myself in the mirror, identifying what I'm great at and what I'm not great at. and then finding people that are great at things that I'm not, and finding a way to formulate a team that we can all kind of watch each other's six. And that's worked really, really well. What doesn't work well, which I experienced many years ago, is forming teams without having clear, concise roles, goals, and compensation for everybody. Just kind of like figuring it out as you go. And then I've had teams not work out because we weren't clear on who was supposed to do what. And we all kept trying to do the same thing, you know, or just didn't do anything, you know, because we weren't clear what we were supposed to be doing. So those have been, that's what worked and what didn't work in building teams.
How do you overcome, or how have you overcome that so that you don't face that lack of clarity, or, you know, non-role definition? What does that look like on a, if you're thinking about adding a role, what's your process for defining what they are, what their position looks like?
Two different things. If you're going to hire an employee or bring in a partner, right? So a partner is someone that I would say is that can do things that I just can't do, or bring some superpower to the table. Like they, like if I'm like the Iron, if I'm the Captain America, they're Iron Man, you know, or they're Thor, or whatever. They just come from a different planet and they just know how to do something that I just have no access to, or a network or a resource that I have no access to. That's partnership. Because then I can compare what they're bringing, what I'm bringing, and we can figure out what each thing is worth. And then that is how I would vet a partner that I can't figure out how to do this thing myself. Because you got to preciously defend equity, you know, in that. I'd rather not give equity away of a thing or ownership away if I could just hire in what they're doing. Now, on the employee side, my wife and I just had this conversation over lunch today, which is if I'm bringing in someone, there's either someone who just helps with overhead, and that's like administrative assistants, or people that are 100% like invaluable for what they do. But once you've got my overhead set up, which I do in my company, I start thinking about growth initiatives for people that I want to put in seats. Let's say that I've got a company and I want to bring in another paid sales associate, or somebody to go and find acquire deals for me, or to go and pound the phones and find opportunities, right? For whatever salary I'm paying them, and they might not be willing to work for straight commission, I want to make at least three times what I'm paying them, right? So if I'm paying them $50K a year, I want to make 150 to cover their salary plus something for my risk factor for bringing that person into house, just in case they don't quite hit their numbers, right? And so that's why I evaluate staff, is that what can you generate? Are you overhead? If you're not, if you are, that's okay. I can't really assign a revenue stream to you. But if I can assign a revenue stream or an expense saving stream or an increase in a income stream, what factor can I apply to what you're going to generate for the global, not just for me personally, but for the company? Because the company kind of becomes its own thing, you know, and it's not me anymore. It's the company, and a lot of people benefit from it. So I want the company to become more healthy for the more people I bring in.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. That's really interesting. What's it look like when you are developing KPIs or things like that for that?
If you're a traction guy, like I am a fan of the book Traction. Yeah. So I found it was funny. I have an operations manager, and I had a healthy debate with him because he's like a rocket scientist by trade. And so he developed KPIs for our team, and no joke, man, there was like 30 KPIs for each team member. And I was like, nah, man, it's like, you need to make that 3 KPIs per person, you know? So we just went back and forth in him and Hod, and we came up with like, okay, KPI for our property manager. And he wanted to have, well, how many showings are they having, and how many this and how many that, and how many online leads did they get, and how many dollars, you know, whatever. We came up with, for a property manager, it's really about, from a leasing perspective, how many units did you lease this month, and how many dollars did you collect on a daily basis? That's it. Increase dissolving my vacancies. That's something you can do great as a property manager. And without collections, you know, and so I got to compare the collections you did this month to what you did last month. And I should know about what my absorption rate should look like for my vacancies. So we look at, just for a specific complex, that could be 3 per month that they're supposed to do. And so, okay, how many did you do? Well, we've only done 1 this month. Okay, great. Why? You know, let's find out. So those are, we find that KPIs, that like, you got to make them as elegant as you can, and the less the better, because I'm not going to measure 30 factors. Yeah, I can measure 2 or 3 or 4, but that's it. So that's how we integrate those things. And you really just got to boil it down to like, what really moves the needle? And because my partner was like, well, you know, how many online ads they posted, it's important to know that. It's not. What's important to know is how many units they leased, and however they got there is how they got there. And if they want to do it through online postings, great. You want to do it through hanging a freaking sign in the front of the place that says for rent, great. You want to do a Facebook ad campaign, do it, right? However they, it gives more ownership away, I think. However they want to generate those leases, I give that ownership to them, and I don't have to micromanage them by saying, well, you're supposed to do a Facebook post at noon on Monday and you didn't do that, and I can manage you for that. You micromanage yourself that way. You micromanage them that way, and they have no ownership. They might as well have a robot do the work.
Yeah, and that kind of, honestly, have you read the book Top Grading?
No, I like that. I'm going to write that down, though. Tell me about it.
Yeah, and I can't remember the author's name, but basically he says, you know, in Top Grading, it's basically a hiring guide or a hiring manual on how to hire the top 10% and always have A players on your team.
Wow.
And it flies in stark contrast, actually, what you just said, which is fine because I love real world examples where he says, hey, you know, you need 50 KPIs. When I read that, I'm like, Lord have mercy. No, like, no, like that'll kill me.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'd like to argue with you, with that author, not you, but A-plus person is going to get ticked off real quick if you've got that many measuring sticks on them on a daily basis, because they're going to be like, I don't need this, man. You don't trust me. That's what 50 KPIs means to me, is you don't trust me. You got to let me have my own little world and make me feel like I own it a little bit and really measure me on what matters, and let what doesn't matter, let me figure that out, you know?
And going back to another book, Phil Knight's book, Shoe Dog, he says, you know, in there, he says, hey, you know, the way I grew my company was by telling people what I wanted them to accomplish, not how to do it.
Yes. Now I believe that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. I was like, oh, that's definitely a paradigm shift, because, you know, we do want to measure, we want to know all these things, but in the end, you found success by just going, hey guys, like, you know, this is what I want the result to be. Go get it. Have you run into any problems with that method?
Which, what, low KPIs or high KPIs?
Low. No, we're just saying, hey guys, this is what I want this to look like. Go get it done.
Yeah, well, I do, because my problem, Sam, is I have a lot of faith. I have a lot of trust in people. And I have, I just like all males that are about our age, I've got ADD, you know, and all that. So I've just got like, what's the next thing? You know, let me wind this person up like a toy doll and let them go and get them all lathered up and excited. But then I want to walk away and do the next thing, right? And the problem that I've had, Sam, is I didn't give that person enough tools to do what they needed to do. And they're like, you know, okay, I'll figure it out. And they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to ask, you know, like, hey, should I do this or do that? And I don't give them enough. Like, I just like point them in the direction, go do this, but I don't give them the tools to do it. And so I've had things fail because they tried their best efforts and they didn't know what questions they were supposed to ask. So they tried to get it done, and whether they were embarrassed to ask or didn't know what to ask, they didn't ask questions and they were under-equipped. And I also, you know, jump out of the parachute, jump out of the airplane quick, put the wrong people in the wrong seats, you know, and I put an ill-equipped either partner and employee in a seat on the bus. And I said, go get them, cowboy. And then they didn't do anything. And it's like, oh, okay. And now I got to get you out of that seat.
Yeah. That's bad for everybody.
Yeah. 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 So that's how it has not worked. But when I put the right people in the right seats, it's been magic. Like, okay, we got this. They've outperformed my expectations, you know?
Right. How do you prevent putting the wrong people in the wrong seat now?
Personality assessments, doing what I don't like doing, which is staying more engaged with them than I like to, and fighting off the ADD of like, hey, and just realizing, I'm going to butcher the quote, so I won't even do it. But, you know, like a pound of precautions worth a, you know,
ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Thank you. Look at you now. Look at you rallying it out. Right. And so I'd rather spend more time in the beginning with them. And I know that's the right thing to do, is to like, I hired an employee, an investor relations manager, just to keep her job is to keep our investors happy. That's it. And so she's constantly working with them and helping them onboard and stuff like that. When I hired her, I did a 15-minute call with her every day, right? Every day. How's it going? What are you doing today? Hey, okay, great. That's not what I want you to do. I want you to work on this, you know, whatever. And just course correct and course correct, course correct. I did that for a month, right? Now her and I talk like every other day, and she now has a virtual assistant that works underneath her. And that's it. We paid off. So I found that the way that you launch the right people is personality assessments, making sure they've got the brain wiring to be sitting in the seat you want them to be sitting in. Make sure you hire the right people. Make sure they're smart enough for the job that you want them to do, right? in that. So yeah, I love people and I have faith in everybody and every kind of stuff, but make sure that the data is right for them to be in that seat. And then also make sure that they are asking the right questions and constant inspection. So I have to fight off my desire to skip off into the sunset, Sam, and find my next thing, find my next adventure for myself. I have to fight that off and just stay with them for a month or two and make sure we hire right. And then they've succeeded well. So
yeah, man, we suffer from the same disease. I think you said it well. Like, hey, man, like, here's your job. Good luck.
Go get him. Right. Go get him. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it works, but you got to gamble. You're gambling there, man. You know, and that's one thing for employees, but for partners, it's different. A partner, you got to expect that they're going to be able to go knock them down and all that. And if they don't, then you got to have, you know, parameters that they end up having to get, you know, switched up or lose your equity, whatever. But to me, that's kind of part of equity, is that you should be able to run a sector of this thing and grow in 10x whatever it is you're involved in without me. That's why you got equity. So I'm not just paying you a salary, you know?
Yeah. Bingo, man. You hit it on the head. Mm-hmm. Matt, I really enjoyed this. Let's jump into the final four. First question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Don't quit. Keep at it and don't quit, man. Because the only way you fail is if you quit. I've screwed up three ways from Tuesday in this business and wrapped my business around a tree 8 different ways. But because I stayed engaged and kept trying and trying it again, like Thomas Edison inventing the light bulb, man, I kept going, you know, and I kept figuring it out. And I find that, yes, some people get to success in year one. It's very rare, but some people do. But most people, it takes a lot of failures and a lot of screw ups to get to success. And the only way you get there is by making it a pact with yourself that you're not going to quit if things get tough. So,
right. Yeah, that's a good word. Question number two is, when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
I am working out every day. Today is April 29th. And that's not when this is going to go live, but April 29th. That's what today is, the day you and I are talking. And I've worked out every day since December 28th of last year. And I find that it has, I'm hooked, man. And I don't work out for long. I'm not doing like hours or running a marathon every morning or whatever. I'm moving my body for 20 to 30 minutes. And I also, that my only term is, I move my body for 20 to 30 minutes and I make sure I break a sweat. That's it. So if I can sweat and I can get active, my adrenaline, my clarity, my focus, my energy, all of it, my peace, my joy, my stress, it's all where I want it to be. Just by me moving my body normally early in the morning, you know, for just a little bit, that's it. And sometimes it's like doing yoga. That's okay. You know, sometimes it's lifting weights. A lot of times it's running, just because I'm like a runaholic, but it's whatever it is. I've even done like stretching and calisthenics for my workouts, or like, you, if I'm in a hotel, do a YouTube video. There's crazy people on YouTube, lunatics that will kick your butt for 20 minutes, do these HIIT workouts. Oh my God. You're jumping around and you're doing pushups and you're doing sit-ups and they give you a 10-second break and you jump. Okay, now go do some burpees, whatever. There's no excuse you can't do that. And it's been something that at 45 years old, I finally figured out, oh, that's a key to mental clarity. So,
man. Right, man. Good for you. Good Thanks, for brother. You. Yeah. There's an amazing amount of exercise you can get in 20 minutes in a hotel room on YouTube.
If you're committed to it and you want to just get after it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Those will kick your butt. That's awesome. Question number three is, when it comes to investing in the world, what is one thing you are doing to make the world a better place?
I'll try not to talk too much here, but the mantra for my company is to transform lives through real estate. And I will not do a deal, Sam, if I don't believe it's not going to make the world a better place. Because it is my mantra. I want to make money. I want my investors to make money too. But I'm committed to transform people's lives through what we do. And that could mean making tenants' lives a little bit better by giving them a playground, or by parachuting in this company called Apartment Life, which is a great apartment community builder. You know, to like build community in your apartment complexes. It's like a dorm manager, like an RA, like we had in college for apartment buildings. It's called Apartment Life. It just anything that I can do that I feel like is going to fight back on entropy and to make things more ordered and better. Cause if they're not managed, they're going to become worse and falling apart. So I try and make things better and more organized.
And that's awesome. Good for you. Matt, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Just my website right here over my head, derosagroup.com, derosagroup.com. They can learn about our education outlets. They can learn about investing with us. And if they want a big bucket of free resources, including all kinds of stuff that we did are on COVID and copies of a lot of my talks, hours worth of video content from me, they can just text the word DeRosa, my company name, DEROSA, to the phone number 66866.
Matt, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.